From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made on stage at the Blackfriars Theater in Rochester this year. I had been invited to offer my minimal skills as a guest actor in the Rocky Horror Picture Show, one time only. They knew my limits. Now, the rest of the cast was, and I say this with no hyperbole, stunning. I was meeting some of them for the first time, and, well, when I met a man named Jay Simmons, he was playing Riff Raff. One of the cast told me that Jay might be the single most talented actor in Western New York. Watching him, I could see why. And it turns out so could City Newspaper. City just released their annual list they call the Rochester 10. 10 people who deserve more public attention. People who are building their communities or succeeding against strong odds or really succeeding in their line of work in extraordinary ways. But people you probably don't know much about until now. Jay Simmons is one of this year's 10, and we thought we'd pull together some of the people on the list for a conversation this hour. We think you will find their work interesting, important, and you'll appreciate their backgrounds and their stories. My first two guests this hour join us in studio, and Jay is one of them. Great to have you here. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for that intro as well.
That is a true story, by the way. Is a true story. Someone said, watch him, probably the best actor in Rochester.
Wow.
And your cast, by the way, in Rocky Horror was amazing.
Yes, every single one of them was
really great.
Through the roof.
It was really great. And Jen Biedemann's here, Advocacy Manager for Common Ground Health. Welcome to you. You've been on the program before. We've been talking about healthy kids. We've been talking about walkable communities. We even talked about Canadian culture.
We have.
You're a Torontonian.
I am a Torontonian.
And a Rochesterian for how long now?
Six and a half years.
What does it mean to you to be on the list of the Rochester 10?
I feel like I'm just so honored and humbled that I get to be put with all of these amazing people, and past, present, future, and just to have come to Rochester, not originally being from here. And, you know, I love this city. I love every part of the city. And so it's so nice to be recognized that people can see how much I love Rochester.
Mm-hmm. Well, listeners, you know how we feel about our relationship with our colleagues at City Newspaper, and we hope you pick up their work every week, especially now as we talk about the Rochester 10, the issue out now, and you can find the full list online at Rochester City Newspaper's website as well. And let's talk about their backgrounds here. Now, Jen mentioned she's from Toronto. Jay is from Rochester.
I am a Rochester native.
And I learned a little bit about you in the piece written by David Andriata for City here.
Yeah, there was a lot of stuff in there.
Yeah, so if you don't mind, let's just talk a little bit about your background.
Okay.
Because you were born to a 14-year-old mom.
Yes.
And someone who you still had a relationship with, your biological mother.
Yes.
But you also had an adoptive family, yes?
Correct.
Okay, so where did you grow up? When you think of your childhood, what does the scene look like?
It looks like Highland Park.
Highland Park.
I was one of the very fortunate people in Rochester that Highland Park was my front yard. Literally, as you open up the front yard, you walk across the street, and that's Highland Park. So as a little kid, I grew up running around and creating, you know, tons of the worlds that I would live in later on as an adult, but creating them in my imagination. It was a really wonderful upbringing, and had a guardian angel of a mother who ended up raising me. So,
would you say that having a lot of space for creative play was helpful to you?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think that as an adult, we forget how to play. I think children are so connected to that. And adults, for some reason, we think there's no value in it as we get older. And my whole career is around that and remembering that and teaching kids, adults, how to do that. So I'm pretty fortunate to live in a world of play. It's fun. It's a lot of fun.
We're going to get to Jen's story coming up here. She's loving that answer. but for you, honestly, I mean, I know that is part of your story. And you said in the piece that David Andriata wrote for City Newspaper that, you know, that you had a lot of opportunities, not just that, but also in your schooling and the opportunity to get on stage, to have those experiences. When did you know that you loved acting?
Oh, man. First time. I still remember it really, really vividly. I was 5 years old in my first, well, 4 and a half in my first show at the Harley School. It was Chicken Little, and I had a very small part, but I just loved, like, when the lights and everything, it just transforms you, and the more you can believe in that world and stay in that world, it makes it very easy. At least it was very easy for me. And you know, people are like, "Do you have stage fright?" It's like, I don't know, something else switches on and you go someplace, and I don't see other people. I'm just in that world with the actors that are on the stage with me, and it was a really, really amazing experience, and it continues to be.
When did you know that you wanted to pursue it for a living?
Oh, man. That is not such an easy answer, just because even when I did pursue it as a living, it still was really, really hard. I mean, it's really hard. You have to constantly push every single day. And I think that as every actor who tries to do this for a living definitely struggles with, why am I doing this? Because there's a lot of effort and not a lot of money. And so it's really hard. You second guess yourself over and over again. But I would say within the, not to quote a show, but in the last 5 years, I have become more resolute in, this is the only thing that I was put on the planet to do, so I'm not going to do anything else.
You are a professional actor.
And yes.
There aren't a whole lot in Rochester just because of how difficult it is to make a living.
Absolutely.
And we'll talk about a little bit more about that in a moment here. But what was your path back to Rochester? Because the piece in City tells a little bit of the colorful things that you have done before you kind of came back and did full-time acting. Take us through that little tour.
So I left Rochester for a little bit, went to and lived a very short stint in New York when I was really, really young, straight out of high school, college age, and then went to Vegas and lived there for a while. Absolutely loved it.
You loved Vegas?
I did. I people are always like, but it's so crazy. It's like, well, you don't live in a casino. I lived
<That's true. laughs>
you know,
that's
like
true.
I lived in a place that was very much like Brighton. It's called Summerlin.
You didn't have like an apartment upstairs at the Spearmint?
No. That was definitely not. Although you think that. You think like, oh my God, these people are transient freaks who just stay there up all night.
Yeah.
I found a place that really values theater and acting and artists. And I think that changed my whole idea, like, oh, okay, well, not every place thinks of this. Like, lots of times when you're in Rochester and it's fine, but a lot of people go, well, what else do you do? You know, like, I'm an actor and a director. And I'm like, yeah, but what else do you do? I teach acting. Yeah, but what else do you do? There it was like, oh, okay.
That's what
awesome. You do. Yeah. There was value in it. And so coming back to Rochester after that experience, I feel, and what brought me back to Rochester is that my mom, who raised me, actually passed away. And so I came back here kind of tying up loose ends and things like that for her, and just said, you know, I've always loved this city, and there has to be a way to make it, you know, and I can make it here. I think I can. But that came with a lot of struggle and second guessing. But there's a lot of opportunities in Rochester. A lot of people don't know that. And that's one of the things that, one of the reasons that, or when I talked about the piece with David, is that there's a lot of opportunities that people just don't go after because they just don't think they're there. But there's movies that are here. There's TV, film, voiceovers, you know, commercials, just straight plays, musicals, tons and tons of stuff. Now, yes, they don't all pay that well, but if you start to get on the circuit and really work, you'll find the work. You'll find the work.
It is, at least it sounds like, the ultimate in the gig economy. I mean, constantly cobbling together and grabbing the next role and thinking about, you know, the next 3 months, we're going to pay the bills this way, and the next 3 months after that.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah, it is. It is. And it's just kind of accepting that that's okay, you know, especially when a lot of other people are like, well, you know, I have my days laid out from here until whenever. Realizing that it's okay to, you know, to have a more unique existence as long as you're continuing to do it and you're striving to be better and you're striving to change others and yourself. I think that it's important. It's important to still do that.
Now, I know you mentioned voiceover work that you do, and listeners hearing your voice understand why.
Thank you.
They're also, you know, you talked about directing, teaching, but when it comes to the actual acting, what's the process that you have at pursuing roles, and especially when it comes to understanding what's available? Because when you say that some people don't know what's available in Rochester, how do you find out? How do you make sure that you're on the map for that, and how are you pursuing that?
Absolutely. I think the first thing that people should do is, you know, just the computer is a wonderful friend. Google all the theaters in Rochester. You can go to each theater's website and look to see when auditions are and things like that. There's production, you know, go to Rochester, type in production companies, type in commercial work, things like that will pop up. And then you'll be able to see these companies. One of the companies that I work with a lot is Stephen James and also LaBarge Media. And, you know, getting tied in to them has been a really great thing in my life and has led to some feature films and different things like that. And so you just have to, I mean, they're literally just signs sitting out there, but you have to go, you have to think creatively. Think, what do you want? Do you want to do voiceovers? Do you want to do commercials? Type in those keywords and start seeing who's responsible for doing those. And then look at their websites or contact those people.
Give me the list of 2019 acting roles that you did, if you can remember them.
Oh, goodness. Can I give you some?
Yeah, yeah. Just kind of rip through as many as you can think of.
Anna in the Tropics.
And where was it? Kind of
that was at Blackfriars.
Yep.
A lot of these are actually, this past year has been really, really exciting at Blackfriars. I love Blackfriars Theater. It's like a second home for me.
Which, by the way, listeners, if you have not been there, it is a phenomenal space.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm partial to the crew there just because, I mean, I know the people, some of the people pretty well. But I'm just so amazed at what they do.
Absolutely.
It's
and,
really great.
You know, it's great people doing great, and I use great as in like magnitude great theater. Anna the Tropics at Blackfriars, Rocky Horror at Blackfriars, then Mauritius, goodness, and then Guys and Dolls, Detroit 67. Now I'm coming up to where I am pretty much right now, and then Next to Normal is the next thing I'll be doing. I'm forgetting some things in the middle.
How often are you doing either commercial voiceover work or even film work?
The way that I'd like it is a couple times per week. Sometimes it's more than that, sometimes it's less than that, but on average probably a couple times a week, doing different gigs or different things like that. And then usually teaching. I also am a stage combat choreographer. So right now I have, just to give you an idea, I have 7 productions that I'm attached to that will start after the new year. So those are solid gigs that are throughout, and then commercials that laid on top of them, and then theater, and then teaching.
How many days off in an average month do you wake up with no work to do?
That's a great question. I would say, With no work to do besides the work that I generate as far as teaching,
yeah,
I would say probably about a week.
Yeah, so it's most of the time you're working in some fashion.
Yeah, yeah, it's probably about the same as everyone else. It's just the hours are different. You know, I get more done in a smaller amount of time than a 40-hour work week.
Now, as much as listeners can hear and appreciate your voice, they can't see you. That's what radio is.
Right.
That's revolutionary. You are a stunningly good-looking guy.
Thank you.
You are in your 30s.
I am. About to be 38. Yeah.
As a guy who just turned 40, ain't nothing wrong with 38.
No, I'm happy about it.
What does a breakthrough... I'm going to reframe this question. Are you looking for a breakthrough? Are you looking for someone to call you and say, we're doing this film. You know, we're doing Knives Out. We want you to play the detective. We want, you know, something like that. Or... Do you feel like this is what I want to be doing?
I am not looking for a breakthrough. Obviously,
okay.
If it comes to my door, will I turn it away? Heck no. But the life that I'm living, to pursue just living art every single day, is exactly what I want to be doing. And I get to teach young kids as well, and that is something that's really, really... I get to teach adults as well, but kids are really special, and they're just so much more open. So that is my goal in life, to just do this. If it leads to other things, and I've, you know, as I said, I've done some tour stuff, I've done some film stuff, but I'm just most happy if I wake up and I get to go do something creative. So as long as that's what's happening from day to day, then I'm set.
Yeah, the reason I ask about the breakthrough is I didn't want to assume that you're mm-hmm. sitting here just waiting for a phone call to come, you know, national, because you're doing great work here.
Yeah.
And again, we're talking to Jay Simmons, who is one of the Rochester 10 chosen by City Newspaper in their annual list of 10 people you ought to know more about. He is considered by many to be among the very, very best actors in Rochester. I was told by a very good source that he's the single best actor in Rochester.
Thank you.
And I know it means a lot to him to hear that. But the reason I ask about the sort of the breakthrough idea is every year there are either films or productions nationally where somebody is breaking out. And I look at you and I think about your resume and I think about the quality of your work and the fact that you're this amazingly good-looking person. I think, I know it's competitive, but you seem like the obvious candidate to explode onto the scene. I think if people like Daniel Ponder should be an international music star and Jay Simmons could be on the scene. Like, honestly. Like,
thank you.
There are people in the city who it would surprise nobody if they exploded nationally.
Thank you.
So, and that's why I asked. But I also didn't want to imply that you're just dying to get out of Rochester.
No,
you're here by choice.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that there's also something really important is that I'm being selected for the Rochester 10 is extremely humbling. And it also reminds me that the only reason why I'm even here is because of all the people that I've worked with in this city who are at the top of their game. When you work with people that are at the top of their game, it only makes you at the top of your game. I had an acting coach named Tim McCormick that was from the West Coast, came back here. I've worked with tons of people at Blackfriars. Danny Hoskins is someone that I look up to. Very good friend. But these type of people keep you pushing. Brian, who was the director of Mauritius, a very good friend of mine, also works at Stephen James. But these people, they force you to be better. So I can't honestly sit here and say that, you know, I am at the top because there's tons of people around me that truly are there with me and that, you know, if it wasn't for them, I wouldn't be sitting in this chair right now.
I think that's gracious at a minimum there. Let me grab a phone call. Jonathan Alima's got a question for you. Go ahead, Jonathan.
Hey, Jay. Yes, Jonathan here. I just had a question for you. I'm listening, and you're, like, inspiring to me. I'm a 34-year-old native of Rochester, and I've actually, you know, had some success, but I'm not anywhere where you are. But I'm intrigued by the idea that, you know, you've had so much success in Rochester.
Yeah.
Because, you know, the whole, everybody says, you got to, like, what are you doing here? You got to get out of here. You know, out of state in California or whatever else. But I guess my question is, I consider myself to be, like, pretty ambitious in trying to find, you know, work and gigs and stuff. I'm a singer.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, how did you start? I got to sing on, like, a commercial that's going to be on the radio probably like 3 months ago, and that was like one of the coolest things I've gotten to do in a few years.
That's awesome.
I've done some other stuff, but like that stuff makes me feel like alive. Like I,
yeah,
you know what I mean? Like being
I do
able
know
to
what you
do
mean.
The stuff like, yeah. So I guess where do you start? I feel like I take advantage of what opportunities are there. Like
sure.
Being, you know, at the Rochester sports teams, games, I've been on, you know, the thing that I did American Idol years ago. And then, so they did like a local thing on me, and I've tried to use that success to go further in what I do in Rochester. But there's so much more I feel that's a potential for that.
Yeah.
I don't really, sometimes I feel at 34, I've hit like a wall, and that's kind of discouraging. But listening to you is really encouraging. And
where do you start looking for work?
Yeah, so the biggest thing.
Where do you start looking for work?
Yeah, the biggest thing is that you have to don't look for work specifically. Look for artistic opportunities. The more that you can become a part of the community, that's really helped me. Lots of times now, because of branching out and doing so many different things, you know, you'll find out just through the grapevine, as it were, once you're inside of a circle, people will let you know that this thing is happening over here, and oh, they have this commercial going on over here, and then there's a voiceover. And the more that you don't look for work, this city's much different than like New York or California or things like that, where you go and you try to find an agency and things like that. It's much more grassroots. It's much more rural, urban type of community. It's a word of mouth community. You have to be a part of the word of mouth. If you're not a part of the word of mouth, you won't work, period. You're talking to me now. I'm on Facebook. If you just go to Facebook and you type Jay and my last name and ask me for a friend request, then you now are connected. and you can ask me anything and send me messages, and I can get you at least a part as much as I can within my, you know, my control. Let you know about opportunities, and we can keep in contact. And that's kind of how it works in this city. So just go to Facebook right now, type it in, and we'll stay in touch, and I'll keep you updated.
And Jay, where can people find your next project? What's next for you?
Next is at Blackfriars Theater. I'm playing a father. It's crazy. I'm playing a father for the production Next to Normal, along with a super, super stunningly talented, amazing cast. I feel very humbled by them. Directed by Carrie Young. And that goes up February 7th, I believe.
February 7th.
I'll be there either way. So, you know.
Let's turn to Jen Biedemann, who is one of the Rochester 10. She's an advocacy manager for Common Ground Health. And again, if you're just joining us, Rochester City Newspaper does an annual list they call the Rochester 10, 10 people you ought to know more about. You just heard Jay Simmons, an actor here in Rochester. Jen Biedemann's an advocacy manager for Common Ground Health. But when you meet people who have never heard of what you do, how do you describe it?
Oh, my gosh. It depends on who you talk to. So I tell everybody that I have the privilege of working alongside residents, youth, and my amazing team as part of a coalition that advocates for kids' health in our region.
And you grew up in Toronto.
I did.
Moved to Rochester, you said, now 6 years ago?
Yep.
What brought you to Rochester?
My husband, Craig. So I fell in love with an American boy, and we did the long distance, and then he moved back home to Rochester, and I came down to help him look for a place and fell in love with the city, which was good because at the time he was living in Buffalo, and Buffalo, Toronto, we have like a kind of
A rivalry?
Rivalry a little bit when it comes to hockey, so I probably wouldn't have lived there.
Well, both hockey teams have been terrible for too long.
They have.
It's a sad state of affairs.
Yeah.
Did you, if I would have told you a decade ago you were living in Rochester, would you have been surprised?
Yes, because I didn't know until I met my husband that Rochester was a city.
Well,
which
right
is
across
so
the lake.
Embarrassing. I know.
I take it you never took the fast ferry here.
I didn't
here.
Even know it existed.
Yeah.
It's so embarrassing. I hate saying that now, but it's true. Like, until I met Craig, I had no idea all of the potential that's happening in Western New York. And
now you're one of the biggest advocates.
And now I'm a big advocate. I love it here.
Were you surprised that Rochester City Newspaper wanted you on this list?
Yes.
Because the people who know you were not surprised.
They were not, but I was. You know, like I said, I work alongside so many amazing people in this community, from nonprofit leaders to residents and youth who are just doing incredible things. And a lot of the time, you know, their stories don't get heard. And so I was surprised that I was picked because I could probably tell you 20 other people that deserve to be here even more than I do for everything that they do to support kids and families and making Rochester just a better place.
Well, again, that's humble of you, but the people who know you were not surprised because what they see in our community is a growing desire to sort of link a lot of different things. We talk about urbanism. We talk about making streets safer for people who aren't just in automobiles. We talk about prioritizing kids and their health. And we don't do it in a way that is, I hope, designed just to be sort of the upper end high-end urbanism. It's supposed to be for everybody. It's supposed to be play-centric, walking-centric, pedestrian-centric. And your work is at the forefront of that. How are we doing? Grade this city in the last year. Give me a grade for 2019. How do we do? Not your agency, but Rochester as a city becoming more, you know, sort of pedestrian-friendly, multimodal, accessible for everybody, better for kids. How do we do?
You know what? I would say that with the adoption of Rochester 2034 and the comprehensive plan, we are on the cusp. Like, you talk to people outside of Rochester about things like placemaking and kids and our, like, the walkability and bikeability, healthy food access. All of that is now embedded in this vision for the next 15 years. And so, you know, even just having worked here at my job over the last 5 years, like, it's not a matter of trying to explain to people the importance of health and the health of a city and why that's an important indicator for urbanism. It's more, okay, we know that, but what can we do now? And it's been a really amazing transition. So I would say we're probably at like, we're at a B. We're a solid B. We have like stuff under our belt now. We have the policies in place. And now it's a matter of how do we move to become not just the policy of the model city, right? But implementing that in a very tangible way.
And how to do that? Well, the piece in City Newspaper for the Rochester 10 has this quote that I'm going to read from you. I want you to tell me more about this. You said, I created all of these infographics showing people we can have playful bus shelters. We can have colorful crosswalks. We can have playful sidewalks. It was a lot of just sharing out those images so people could see, oh, this is possible here. So what's the vision? What's our city look like when it's in an A?
When it's in an A, you would see, you know, you'd see bike lanes everywhere, right, that are protected. You would see cars, scooters, motorbikes, pedestrians, cyclists of any age, right, being able to use the streets outside. You would have any child in any neighborhood, regardless of what they were living, have access to healthy food, a place to play in their neighborhood. They would feel safe in their neighborhood, right? We would see, you know, all these incredible new ways of thinking about environment. So you talked, like, in I was quoting all these different ideas of, you know, when we launched our Play Rocks campaign, we really looked at back to data that we had collected in neighborhoods where we asked residents, where are kids playing? How can we make this better? And what we found in doing those assessments alongside folks in the city is that neighborhood safety, traffic safety, and the state of our playgrounds were really deterring parents from letting kids play outside. And so what that meant is once we found out what the barriers are, we can start proposing different solutions. And so when I came on board, I started looking at what's happening in other communities across the country. What does play look like there? Because this movement around play is not unique to Rochester. Those barriers are not unique. And we see across the country, even in Canada too, that, you know, kids are not having the amount of unstructured playtime that they need. And it's really critical for them. And so, you know, looking around, you see things like swings at bus stops, hopscotch on a kid's walk, like on the sidewalk between maybe their rec center to school. You see amazing playful sculptures and all of these different ways that we can think about space creatively and in a different way, and that you can turn those everyday destinations into moments of wonder, into moments of play, into moments of connection between kids, their families, or just even, you know, adults getting to know one another in their city, right?
Yeah, and it sounds to me like that does two things. It creates actual space for play, but it also changes a culture. Yeah?
Yes, exactly. It's about, you know, all of the projects that I have gotten to work with folks on, whether it's the play walk or the story walk at Phyllis Wheatley or the Beechwood story walk, it all really starts with this idea that you bring everybody together from the very beginning. So you're bringing together not just the city folks that can make it happen, but you're bringing together the residents, the kids, getting their feedback and input. And what happens is you create a project that really has a sense of community ownership of that place. And in doing so, it's not just one person's project. It's everybody's project. And so there's a sense of ownership that comes from that. So it's like the community building that happens from these projects are huge. And, you know, I have this one family that I worked with really closely throughout this campaign. And, you know, their Heather and her five daughters, they helped paint the story walk. And so to this day, that story walk was created. It was our first project almost 3.5 years ago. To this day, those girls, anytime there's someone new in their car, they have to drive by Phyllis Wheatley Library and say, that's the project that we did. We made that. Right? And that's important. You know, you want kids to have that sense of ownership of space and know, like, that I was a part of transforming our city.
Well, we're talking to Jen Biteman, who's one of the Rochester 10. You heard Jay Simmons, an actor, earlier this hour. In a moment, we're going to talk to Leslie Danks Burke, who is the founder of the Trailblazers Pack. City Newspaper is out with its annual list of 10 people you should know or really know more about. That's the Rochester 10. But two more questions for you on this subject of play. My twin brother works, he's a science teacher now, which is amazing because of our science history in our family, but also has spent his career working with kids and talks to me with some frequency about how there are families who almost fear unstructured time. Like they think they need to have every hour blocked out. After a child is done with school for the day, well, you can't be doing nothing. You have to have an activity planned, and you know, like they fear it. And as much as we can talk about electronics and video games and whatnot, like leading to the death of play, we had video games growing up. But he is observing more and more fear of unstructured time. Are you, and what do you say to parents who are scared of that?
I say, this is something we run into a lot, right? There's been a shift in our culture, as I was saying, with, you know, No Child Left Behind and all of this, like, legislative pressure. And then you see now, like, laws having to be created to allow free-range parenting, which basically says that a kid can go out and play. And so what I share with kids is, with parents, is one, trying to figure out, like, well, why? Why are you afraid of unstructured play, right? To understand where they're coming from. Mm-hmm. But, you know, unstructured play is actually developmentally appropriate for kids. It's how they learn. It's how they learn important social-emotional skills like teamwork, problem-solving. You know, we're by not letting kids have that opportunity for unstructured play, we're actually robbing them of development, of their imagination and developing that, right? Like Jay was talking about, he was out in Highland Park playing all day, getting to use his imagination. That's what we need. That's what kids need, not just for the social emotional benefits, not just because that's how they learn, but also it's because it's okay for a kid to be a kid. It's okay for them to go out and fall down and learn how to get back up and do it all again the next day. And there's also, you know, the physical benefits that come from that too, of, you know, it helps. It's also very healing, surprisingly. If you have a child who has multiple adverse childhood experiences, it's science actually shows that kids can heal through play as well. So
what's next for you in 2020? I asked Jay that question. What's most immediately up next for you?
Most immediately up next is we actually, after the installation of the Play Walk, we applied for more funding to create another element for the Play Walk. And so coming up in February, we've hired internationally known, they make a lot of play infrastructure called the Urban Conga. So they're going to be coming and doing a community engagement session. And so I would say if you want to learn more about next steps for the Play Walk or how to get involved with Healthy Kids and our advocacy work to find me, you can go to Common Ground Health's website or Healthy Kids' website. It's healthy with an I. And just get in touch. And we would love to have people coming out and joining us and to help make Rochester a better place to play.
There's a bit of a scandal here, you know. The editor of City Newspaper, David Andrietta, is also a Torontonian.
I know.
You got a little bit of Homerism there.
I did. And, I met David when we were on your show talking about all things Canada. So
it has served you well. No, I know that the people who know Jen's work are so proud of your selection for this list. Congratulations on that.
Thank you so much.
Jen Biedemann, Jay Simmons with us in studio. Let's get our only break of the hour. We'll bring in Leslie Danks-Burke, who is also one of the Rochester 10 in City Newspaper. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. When Rochester City Newspaper put out their list of the Rochester 10 in 2019, just this week, which, by the way, you ought to be picking up City News and City Newspaper every single week because, well, I'm biased and we work with them, but they do great work, and I hope you're doing that. The current edition is out now. You might have been surprised to see Leslie Danks-Burke on there, the founder of the Trailblazers Pack, just primarily because we got to get you on the phone. Where are we talking to you today from, Leslie?
Hi, great to hear from you, Evan. I am at my office. We're based in Horseheads, New York, which is in the southern tier of New York State, sort of near Elmira.
And so we're going to talk about why you're on the Rochester list, but were you surprised? What did you make of your selection for the Rochester 10?
I was thrilled. I was surprised. I figured that it was because we at Trailblazers PAC have endorsed so many candidates in Monroe County. We're a statewide PAC up until the beginning of 2019, and then in 2019 we went national and started working with candidates anywhere in the country. In fact, we worked with candidates in 12 different states in 2019. But just interestingly, it's ended up that a real substantial number of our candidates have come from Monroe County, and so I think that I guess that's why they decided to reach out to us, and it felt really good.
I think it makes a lot of sense, and one of the things I think that would sort of simplify what it is you do, when people might ask, because I've talked to Leslie on this program before, the way I describe it, Leslie, is this is a PAC that's trying to make politics the way most Americans would like it to be. But how do you describe what you're trying to do?
That's a great explanation, Evan. It is a PAC that's trying to get politics back to what our founders expected that it would be. If you go back and you look at the founding documents, there wasn't really a time that our founders imagined that we would have to jumpstart people to get to the polls. They were so antsy to be able to vote themselves. They couldn't imagine a time when we wouldn't want to vote, or we wouldn't be able to find time in our busy lives to vote. And so what we're trying to do is re-engage voters with democracy and make sure that our politicians and elected leaders are working for the people who are the most important people in our democratic republic, and that's the voters.
We're going to talk about how you're doing that in just a second, but a little bit of history. As noted in the city newspaper piece profiling you as one of the Rochester 10, you were running for state senate in 2016, and that experience was pretty instructive to you. How?
It was. I was running for state senate in a pretty rural conservative district in the southern tier of New York State. And it is not a district that gets a lot of attention from, you know, the power players across the state that tend to donate to candidates on both sides of the aisle. Actually, most of the donations in New York State to state-level politicians come from two zip codes, one in Albany and one in New York City. And neither one of those zip codes was very interested in this race that was in a far-flung corner of New York State. And so we had a hard time getting attention. And what we ended up doing was bringing the campaign directly to the voters. We fundraised directly from the voting members of the community that we were seeking to represent. And we also 100% disclosed every single penny in and out of the campaign. And that turned into a really powerful combination, because not only was the campaign financed by the people who, you know, stood to actually benefit from having a representative who really recognized their interests, as opposed to representatives who tend to be funded by outside interests, they also knew about each other, because a lot of the donations that come into politics are at a lower threshold that sometimes doesn't get reported. New York has a loophole that doesn't require that candidates disclose every single donation below $100. And we went ahead and disclosed all those, honestly, because it was too complicated to try and figure out a different way to do it. It was just a lot easier to disclose everything.
But let me just jump in here, because this is where this is where listeners might get to this part of the story and think, huh, the concern is there's a loophole that says if you give less than $100, you don't have to have a name disclosed. But then listeners might think, well, so what? You're not going to be influenced by $48 from somebody. How is that a concern? What's the answer, Leslie?
You got it, Evan. It's really interesting. Those little donations add up over time. And we did a study at Trailblazers PAC early in 2017 where we took a look at all of the undisclosed donations that came from, you know, that threshold below $99 or less. And it turned out that $1 in $8 in New York State politics comes in through that loophole. It was a total of about $31 million in 2017. One out of every $8 is not reported because it comes in through that loophole. I think it was several hundred thousand dollars in Monroe County. It was maybe $450,000 in Monroe County over a period of years. That is a lot of money. And so, yeah, it's coming in through these small donations, but if they happen over and over and over again, and they're coming from the same interest over and over again, they really add up, and they can start to have real influence, especially in local level races when the budgets are so small, right? So if you're running for town board or city council person, you're not going to be spending millions of dollars on your race. You're probably going to be spending like $10,000 on your race. And so in a $10,000 race, if somebody gives you $100, that's actually a pretty significant contribution in that particular race. And if they do it over and over, it starts to really add up.
And so if the money is coming from outside of a district, why does that trouble you?
Well, we aren't telling candidates to decline money from anywhere. We're not saying turn this down. What we're trying to do is create an incentive for them to do it a different way, to do better. Instead of saying turn down corporate money or turn down outside interest money, we're saying go first to your voters. Sure, you know, take whatever money you feel like you need to take from outside interests, but go directly to your voters, have those conversations, see if you can get literal buy-in from the people who are your boss once you're elected. You know, anybody who's elected, they have a performance review every couple of years in the form of another election. And those voters should know what you've been doing while you've been in office. And if you have an incentive of you have to pay for these campaigns by connecting with your actual voters, then you talk to them periodically about what it is you're doing in office, and you get a real sense of whether they like how you're performing.
So what are the rules? If I'm running for a local office, and Trailblazers focuses on county and smaller, and we'll talk a little bit about whether that could change coming up here, but if I'm running for local government, how do I get endorsed by your PAC?
We invite any candidate who wants to apply for our mentorship, and we put candidates into a mentorship program where we give them advice on, you know, really just the nuts and bolts of how to run for local office. That information is a little bit opaque for a lot of people. Most people who want to go into politics, into their local community, they do it because they care about a particular issue and they want to make the community better. Maybe they've been on the PTA in their community, or they've been an activist in, you know, a local zoning issue, for example, and they've decided to run for town board or for city council. But it's really hard to find out how you do that. That information isn't always readily accessible. So we put candidates into a mentorship program. They can stay in the mentorship program as long as we really get the sense that they're striving to meet our two objectives of disclosing every single penny in and out of their campaign, and also fundraising from at least 1% of the voting households in their district. So they have to go to at least 1% of the homes and invite those people to fully buy in or actually become literally invested in the campaign. And the analogy I use is it's like when you go to a ball game and you decide to buy the jersey of the team or the baseball cap of the team. Once you're wearing that jersey or that baseball cap, you're literally invested in the outcome of that game. You want to see the team whose logo you're wearing, you want to see them win. And it's a way to get voters more engaged, and it's even more importantly, a way to make sure that the candidate who's running understands that he or she is supposed to be beholden to the people that put him there.
First time I read that rule, I think I thought, only 1% of the households? That is not that high a bar. That's pretty easy. And then I started thinking about it, and I thought, it's probably easier to just raise a ton of outside money than to actually get one out of every 100 homes, not to endorse you, not to put a lawn sign, but to give you money, to actually make a contribution to the campaign. That is a lot harder than I think it probably sounds at first. Do you agree?
You're absolutely right. It is a surprisingly low threshold that almost no candidates reach.
Yeah.
It is really hard for someone to reach our Trailblazers threshold. We knew how hard it was when we set it forth. We've mentored, I think, close to 250 candidates now. We've been doing this for about 3 years, and only 57 of them have made it to our endorsement. So only about 1 in 5 candidates actually, you know, reaches that threshold. We do keep on working with them all the way up until Election Day, as long as we, you know, feel like they're still striving to do that. But you're right. It is it's so much easier to just, if you have a $10,000 campaign, go to the local Republican committee or the local Democratic committee, get a $1,000 check from them, go to your Uncle Joe in California who's always loved you and have him write you a $1,000 check, call up a couple of local businesses, and pretty soon you've got your $10,000 and you didn't have to talk to any of your voters. And what we want is for candidates to go directly to their voters and say, look, campaigns cost money right now. And as long as they still cost money, I might as well make myself accountable to you as to some outside interest that wants to donate money to this particular city council race for whatever reason.
Yeah. And so as you grow with the Trailblazers PAC, will you keep it local? Will you focus on state and national races and let listeners know why you're not so far doing that?
We love the local races because those are the ones that are most important. Those are the people who decide where your kids go to
often
school.
Often the most forgotten, too.
They are forgotten.
Yeah.
And they are also the ones that are the most susceptible to money in politics corruption. And that's counterintuitive, too. People think about these millions of dollars that big interests siphon into, you know, presidential campaigns or congressional campaigns. We hear about it all the time. That's nothing compared to the influence that a donor to a local race can have because the budgets are so small, right? That $10,000 race, you donate $5,000, you bought half the race. And you can do that pretty cheap, and you can do it over and over and over in lots of different races. So the loopholes that are there that allow really substantial contributions with a significantly greater effect in local level politics than they do in higher up races, that's where this change really needs to happen. That's where we're really focused on the money in politics problem. And also on the issues that are closest to voters. Are there going to be potholes? Is the road going to be plowed when you want to go to work? Is there going to be a supermarket in your district? Are you going to be able to reach food or not? Is a out-of-town business going to come and build a power plant? You know, is there going to be housing that you can afford? Whatever the issue is, it's your local politicians who decide those.
Yeah, and if you think about it, politics as a game, the NBA has been sort of revolutionized by the amount of three-point shots teams are taking because somebody in the statistics department figured out that it's a lot more valuable and they ought to be shooting a lot more of them. And now there's calls to move the line back, but teams are basically saying, well, until you move the line back, these are the rules, and we're gonna do it this way, which is what some people in politics say about money in politics. Well, the rules say we can bundle money and we can you know, collect money under $100 a pop and not disclose it. That's the rules. Are you someone who's saying, okay, if that's what the rules are, we're going to play it this way in our pack, and we're going to try to exert our influence in our own way, but we also want the rules to change? Or do you think the rules don't have to change, that we can have a healthy political system without a wholesale rules change, Leslie?
I love your NBA example. I'm going to take that and play with that a little bit. There's a way to spin that one out that I find fascinating. But what we think is that candidates can choose to follow a higher standard even before the rules change. And here's the wonderful piece, is that when they choose to do that, when they choose to be more accountable to their voters than law currently requires them to, they aren't just honest, they're also more powerful candidates. They're more likely to win. Our candidates, our Trailblazers, have won at a rate of 71%. And that's tremendous. Even more exciting than that is that voter turnout, and this is anecdotal, you know, statisticians out there are going to say there's just not enough of a data pool to really draw a statistical sample there. But anecdotally, in one community after another where we have had a Trailblazer running, the voter turnout has been higher than in comparable districts where there wasn't a Trailblazer on the ballot. And that's true whether the Trailblazer wins or loses. And so that's a real optimistic view of democracy, that when a candidate chooses to make him or herself accountable to their own voters, that it also engages more voters, it brings more people into the political process, everybody wins.
Where can people find you online to learn more, Leslie?
We are at trailblazerspack.com, and we support candidates of any political party. They can be Republicans, Democrats, conservatives, independents, non-registered, whatever they want to be. They just have to follow these higher standards of clean government because we believe that that's what's going to make our Democratic Republic count again.
Congratulations on the selection of the Rochester 10. Thanks for being here, and I know we're going to talk again in 2020.
I appreciate it. Thanks so much, Evan.
That's Leslie Danks-Burke, the founder of the Trailblazers PAC. She's one of the Rochester 10. We had talked to Jen Biedemann and Jay Simmons in studio, so real quick on that theme, Jay Simmons. Rochester, the city newspaper wants Rochesterians to know more about people like Leslie and Jen and you. What does that translate to in 2020? More people going to see theater?
I hope so, or more people thinking what they can contribute to the community, even if it's not necessarily to go see theater. But how do you fit your own personal puzzle piece to this community, and what makes you special? And really, I think the biggest message, at least through my intention of when I was interviewed, was, you know, you may not be on the cusp of something great or mm-hmm. things like that, but that doesn't mean that your voice isn't important or that your dream isn't important, and to really awesome. Just follow that.
20 seconds. What's it look like in 2020 if people are supporting this, the work that you're doing?
It looks like people going out to city council, connecting with us, taking over places in their own neighborhoods for play. It can be as something small as a play street to something as big as a project.
Congratulations to both of you.
Thank
in the studio.
Thank you so much.
There's seven more names and people that we didn't even get to this hour. You got to pick up City Newspaper to learn more. Rob Braden is the engineer. Megan Mack is the producer. David Griffin volunteering with us today. Thank you, David. Goodbye and thank you to the great work of Christina Damo, one of the wonderful people who's been volunteering with us. We'll miss her in 2020. Have a great weekend. And by the way, if we missed you earlier this week, and if you celebrated, Merry Christmas belatedly, Happy New Year. We're going to talk to you soon on Connections.